Let's get started. So I'd like to remind the audience, first of all, to mute themselves and turn the video off. You can unmute yourself when you ask a question. So today's speaker is Dima Banin. So well, just like previous speakers, Dima hardly needs an introduction, but I'll introduce him anyway. So Dima was very briefly a faculty at Perimeter Institute here in Waterloo, but then unfortunately left for University of Geneva. So Dima has done a lot of very well-known work early on graphene, but so in recent years he's been very active in the field of many-body localization and non-equilibrium quantum dynamics. He's really one of the leaders of this field now. And so today he's going to tell us, I guess, about some recent developments in this area. So please, Dima, you can start.
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Anton, for the introduction, and thanks for having me here. Well, online, of course. You know, it's a pity it cannot be done in person, and the saddest thing of all that we won't be able to have a beer and chainsaw after the talk. Because the audience, I see that it's a pretty big audience, so I will start sort of slow, and we'll try to give you a broad overview of the field. And that should be a bit boring for experts, right? But then towards the end, I'll get to the most kind of to the most recent thing that we're quite excited about. And there, you know, so for the expert, you know, maybe for the first half an hour, just tune out and then tune back in half an hour. I'll start with just giving an overview of non-equilibrium quantum phenomena viewed through the prism of quantum entanglement. And so we all know that quantum many-body problems are hard, and the basic reason is this quantum exponential wall, which is essentially just the fact that many-body Hilbert space grows exponentially with the number of degrees of freedom, right? And that was, you know, a famous statement by Feynman that if you want to make a simulation of nature, you'd better make it quantum mechanical. It's a wonderful problem because it doesn't look so easy, right? And he was referring to the fact that a priori, classically simulating quantum phenomena, quantum many-body phenomena, is not natural. It's very hard because of this quantum exponential wall. And the cool thing is that thanks to our experimental friends, right now we have more and more different systems of that kind which can do quantum simulation. And sometimes they refer to as synthetic quantum systems. You know, prime example perhaps is systems of ultra cold atoms. And the nice thing about ultra cold atoms and other quantum simulators is that they're very tunable. So you can design the dimensionality of your system, put up a lattice, tune it, disorder, interactions, you know, various things that, that you might be interested in. The way the systems have been used is both to emulate phenomena that we find in condensed matter, like Hubbard model, but also, you know, these are interesting systems in their own right. They're very much unlike conventional materials, so they're isolated. They're just hanging out there in a laser trap, so there is no phonon or heat bath, and they have very long time scales compared to materials. And because of that, they prove to be a good platform to study non-equilibrium phenomena because you can essentially in real time see what interactions do to your system. And also the kinds of experiments that one can do in these systems are often quite different from what we are used to in condensed matter, right? Like it's not measuring heat capacity or conductivity, but rather doing, for example, a quantum quench experiment. So you can really prepare your atoms in some, you know, sitting in some places in the lattice, and then you let them interact and evolve and see what happens. And moreover, you can characterize this evolution with single site resolution. So here is an example from Emanuel Bloch. So atoms are launched in this half moon configuration, and then they expand in a disorder potential. They're interacting, and you can see how they fill up this circle. And also another interesting thing you can do, you can shake the system. So it's it's a good platform to study periodically driven systems. And also just to mention it, so please stop me, ask questions, or send them to the chat. So I'll be very grateful for any questions, because the silence when you give a Zoom talk is a bit strange. So just a couple of words on what kind of quantum simulators we have right now. So there are called atoms, superconducting qubits, qubit arrays, which are in particular pursued by Google. And these really have gone a long way. And now I think they're at the stage where they can simulate interesting non-equilibrium phenomena as well. Also Rydberg atom arrays, in particular from, pushed by Harvard-MIT collaboration. And another completely different kind of systems, which is less kind of assembled from atoms, but more just found naturally, is nitrogen vacancy spins in diamond. And I will touch on a couple of these platforms in this talk. Simplest setup that one can first think about in this quantum quench. So you initialize your system in a non-equilibrium configuration, like this spins being in a classical state pointing up and down, and then they evolve, right? And you can ask all kinds of questions. So do they reach a steady state? What kind of steady state? Is the steady state correlated with the initial state, right? How do you approach it? Ideally, we would like to have the understanding of universality classes. In equilibrium, we know there is a lot of universality, and we can define the notion of phase of matter, so which, where the main principle is symmetry breaking. And so we would like to understand what is the organizing principle out of equilibrium. And the hope is that this understanding would enable a more efficient control of synthetic systems. Now, the most natural possibility is that you start out in a non-equilibrium state, things mix up, right? Energy is distributed, and then you end up in thermal equilibrium, right? And in statistical mechanics, so we learned that systems which are ergodic, like this billiard, so which can explore all the corners of phase space, they're the ones which thermalize, right? And that's where you start building statistical mechanics and define temperature and so on. Now, it turns out, that in the quantum world, there are exceptions. There are systems which do not thermalize. And just to give you a small preview, so one way to avoid thermalization is disorder. And this goes back to the idea, to the ideas of Anderson, to Anderson localization. So Anderson foresaw that localized system would be one where approach to equilibrium is impossible. Indeed, in recent years, so as many of you know, there has been a lot of work on this phenomenon of, what happens to Anderson localization when you add interactions with between particles, and turns out that you get this new phenomenon of many-body localization, and that's a prime example of a generic non-ergodic phase. In recent years, many interesting ideas emerged how to use the fact that, you know, your system doesn't thermalize. So, you know, some limitations imposed by statistical mechanics are not there. And then you can get interesting non-equilibrium behavior, which is sometimes surprising. So now a small reminder about the role of entanglement, right? So we know that a generic many-body wave function of n spins 1/2 is very heavy, sort of it requires a lot of parameters, 2^n parameters, right? But states which are not super entangled, which obey area law, right? Meaning that entanglement entropy of some subsystem in the state psi scales with the volume of the boundary of the subsystem, right? That's called area law or boundary law. Such states can be efficiently compressed using polynomial number of parameters. And most ground states are here, so they are in a sense easy. Of course, this is an overstatement. They're not easy at all. But at least you have this route forward using tensor networks to compress them. While states where entanglement scales extensively with the volume of the subsystem, right? Highly entangled states, they're hard to describe. And generally you expect that non-equilibrium states are in this class, right? They should be hard. Now, you know, a couple of words about ergodicity in the quantum world. So there is a set of ideas which goes under the name eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which tells you what eigenstates of quantum ergodic Hamiltonians look like. And the picture is ultimately very intuitive and quite simple. So if you take an excited eigenstate of a Hamiltonian, excited means there is finite energy density, right? It's not just one excitation, but rather some density of excitations. Then in this eigenstate, effectively observables would look thermal, right? They would be equivalent. So reduced density matrix of a sufficiently small subsystem would look thermal. So colloquially, you could say that the system acts as a heat bath for its subsystems. And of course, one consequence of this picture is that the eigenstates are volume low entangled, right? Because the entanglement entropy essentially is the same as thermodynamic entropy, and that's extensive, that we know, right? So that's why the excited eigenstates of the systems are naively, you know, they're hard to describe. They have a lot of entanglement. Now, a very simple argument for why it might be interesting to avoid thermalization. So let's now think about, again, this quantum quench experiment, and let's say that we prepare an initial state where we write some, you know, some piece of information. Let's say we prepare these two spins pointing up. Then if the system thermalizes, so what happens, this operator sigma z, it time evolves and it becomes a big operator, right? So the information is not going away, but it becomes distributed over lots of complicated operators which you have no access to, right? So in a sense, the system falls to this, you know, very featureless thermal state, and you know, this leads to scrambling of quantum information. And so sort of at a very intuitive level, you might think that, well, to protect coherence, I want to find mechanisms of avoiding or slowing down thermalization. And I'll give you a couple of examples. So, but maybe this is a place to stop and ask if there are any questions already. So, okay, so if not, I will continue. So, and let me give you a brief, you know, brief picture of what this many-body localized phase is like. You know, these are things that are by now pretty old, and actually many of them were done at perimeter, and, you know, by myself and Zlatko Papic and and Anusha Chandran and Isaac Kim, who were at the time all at Perimeter. So the recipe of recipe to get many-body localization is simple. So there is this formula that one can write. So what you need to get many-body localization is a strong quench disorder, short-range interactions, meaning, let's say, no power law interactions. That's a separate interesting problem, but let me not touch it today. You want to push the system strongly out of equilibrium, meaning you consider states which have finite energy density, right? Rather than, let's say, one excitation on top of the ground state. And then you can think either about fermions, for example, like these fermions in the disorder potential with nearest neighbor interactions, or spins, right? And for spins, you can have on-site disorder, so just a random field pointing in the Z direction independently on each side, distributed with some variance W. Flip-flop term, J, so that would generate dynamics, entanglement, and it's like kinetic energy. And you have interactions, sigma Z, sigma Z. And the dynamical phase diagram quite generically looks like that. So at very strong disorder, you have many-body localization, and at weak disorder, things are thermal, right? So it becomes quantum ergodic, satisfies ETH. ETH stands here for the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. In Switzerland, it's usually the institution in Zurich. First question that arises, whether interactions are actually important, right? Because both Anderson localization and many-body localized phase, right, from the point of view of sort of condensed matter probes, they both have zero conductivity. So you might think naively that they're actually the same beast. And this is where this whole way of thinking, inspired by quantum simulation and synthetic quantum system proved very useful. Right, so and the key was to consider quantum quench setup. So you start out the system in a product state, and you let it evolve, and you ask, how does quantum information spread? So how does entanglement between left and right part grow? And that was done. So that was done first numerically, and what was found that even though there is no particle transport, actually, as soon as you turn on interactions, even very weak, quantum information starts spreading, and it does so in a characteristic logarithmic in time manner, right? So here you see it on this plot. Different curves are different values of interaction. And so this is, of course, counterintuitive. So how come the system, even though things don't move, so entanglement still spreads, though very slowly. And the resolution of this puzzle so led to the understanding that of the many-body localized phase as a kind of phase with emergent integrability, and the very sort of impressionistic picture is like this. So you can start out at infinite disorder limit, where effectively you can throw out the kinetic energy term, and your eigenstates, all eigenstates would become simply product states with zero entanglement, right? And it is so because this limiting Hamiltonian commutes with the sigma z operator on every side. So you have tons of conservation laws, and the picture of the many-body localized phase, with finite kinetic energy, is that you actually, so your eigenstates stay slightly entangled, right? You can dress up this product states a little bit, create a little bit of local entanglement by a sort of canonical transformation, and in this way construct exact eigenstates and see that there is a set of local integrals of motion. So local means that they mostly act on a few spins, right, in some vicinity, but do not touch spins far away very strongly. And another way to say it, so that you found a basis of qubits with infinite T1 time, right, which are quasi-local, so you can imagine addressing them, measuring them, and so on. And this low entanglement of excited eigenstates tells you that the MBL phase is, in some sense, is simple, right? And you can try to compress the eigenstates efficiently by tensor networks. And there are various interesting attempts to build new algorithms based on that fact. That I think is largely work in progress, although there has been some nice proof of principle works. And once you found this nice basis of where Z projections of these effective spins are conserved, then things become easy. So you just go to that basis and you can solve for dynamics, and there are remnant interactions between the effective conserved spins, which decay exponentially, just like tails of Anderson wave function, localized wave function, and this weak interaction leads to very long time scales, right, which grow exponentially with the separation. And interesting consequence of this is that if you do a quantum quench on the system, they equilibrate, but to a state that is highly non-thermal and that is correlated with the initial state. Because this tau z operators are quasi-local and they're conserved, right? And that's very much unlike ergodic systems, right, which completely forget about the initial state and just remember about global things like energy, particle number, and so on. So
can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
So this picture, you started out with a phase diagram, generic phase diagram separating MBL and thermal phases, and then I talked about this almost conserved quantities. This is educational, essentially. To what extent does it depend on dimensionality of your system? It seems like you're kind of thinking about 1D, but is it the same in all dimensions?
So that's a good question. So I think modulo rearrangement effects, which are still being discussed, right, in two dimensions and higher, I think the picture would stay. Now there could be, so the whole debate about higher dimensions is that, you know, you might have a region of space where disorder happened to be weak, right, and you would have a small thermal bath. It would happen rarely, right, but then there is an argument, you know, due to Wojciech Dirac,
Couveniers. Okay, actually, right? Okay.
Now
three spins can thermalize everything.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
And you know, this is still a bit up in the air because people are essentially out of methods to probe it.
Right.
So you know, when the Munich group did experiments on 2D up to timescales they could go to, they haven't seen the evidence of that. Right. So I think the minimal, you know, the sort of conservative thing I can say is that at the very least, there would be a very long time scale, right, up to which this phenomenology would probably hold also in two dimensions, right, and higher. Now, there could be this avalanche effect, but then you can also, right, if... that's indeed there, you can still play the game of maybe designing a potential which does not have rare regions, right? And in cold atoms, they can do it.
Okay.
So does it,
Thank
does
you.
It? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, okay, any other questions so far?
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So I saw many times this Hamiltonian in terms of integrals of motion for spins. Now, you also mentioned fermion systems in random potential. So what would be the equivalent of that Hamiltonian for fermion systems?
Very good question. Yeah, thanks, Jose. So it would be essentially occupation numbers instead of occupation numbers of some orbitals instead of tau z's, and then interactions among them.
I see. So like, it would be a bunch of commuting terms again.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
So, okay, if there are no other questions, I continue. So, and, you know, just a cartoon comparison of quantum and classical situation. So, you know, of course, in the classical world, we also have integrable systems, right? Let's say if I have this billiard with rotational symmetry, it would have extra conservation laws and motion would be regular rather than chaotic, right? And you can ask whether this regular motion survives some degree of perturbation. And to answer this question, there is a classic Kolmogorov-Arnold-Moser theory, right, which tells you exactly what are the conditions to retain regular motion, how strong the perturbation could be, and so on. But it applies only to few body systems, right? And one, you know, I think one funny example of this weakly perturbed integrable system is our solar system. There are many parallels between what I described and Kolmogorov-Arnold-Moser theory. So in particular, you know, disorder, in a sense, it ensures that there are, you know, fewer resonances in your system, right? And there is a condition like that in KM theory. But the difference is that while in the classical world, you know, you can only take weak perturbation for few body systems, in at least in one dimension, NBL is believed to be a stable phase of matter, right? And in higher dimensions, it's, I think, the current situation as I described in when answering Dima's question, right? So, and this big difference probably just stems from the fact that in the quantum case, you have discrete energy levels. So Dima, that's just a summary of sort of contrasting the eigenstate properties and spreading of correlation in ergodic systems versus MBL. So you have lots of entanglement here and very little entanglement there. Usually in ergodic systems, the spreading of correlation is ballistic or some, you know, power law in time, while here it's glassy and very slow. So, and we'll come back to this picture in a second. So in experiments, what people do is exactly the kind of quantum quench experiment. So here is a pioneering experiment by the Munich group. So they have this quasi-random optical lattice in one dimension, and then they initialize the atom in a charge density wave pattern and just see whether as the system evolves, it relaxes or not. And here is a phase diagram on the x-axis interaction, on the y-axis disorder. And you see that at strong enough disorder, irrespective of interactions, you go into this non-ergodic localized phase. And more recently, there has been very nice, you know, nice experiments going beyond this relaxation, right? Just looking at the relaxation of some imprinted pattern. So an experiment from the Harvard group extracted how configurational entanglement entropy grows, and they saw this signature of the slow logarithmic growth of entanglement, right? And that's really what distinguishes MBL phase from the ergodic phase, from the Anderson localized phase. Now this is not the main thing I want to talk about, but let me just tell you sort of very superficially about a couple of cool applications of ergodicity breaking, and then we'll proceed to other things. So first, you know, first implication of the existence of the conservation laws is that you can largely protect quantum coherence. Because, you know, so indeed quantum correlations spread, but they do so in a very special way, right? Because tau z's are still conserved. So it is really just dephasing, right? Dephasing due to interactions between them. And you can play the usual tricks from quantum optics and restore coherence actually with spin echo and do some other nice, you know, nice quantum optics type experiments like double electron-electron resonance to probe this remnant interactions between remote qubits, right? Remote tau operators. And so recently we've been working with the Google group, demonstrated experimental signatures of that, right? So they could do a spin echo type experiment with their array of superconducting qubits. And another application that people have been excited about is that MBL can enable neutron equilibrium phases with properties that you would not, you cannot have in thermal equilibrium. And here the key class of system that has been studied is Floquet systems, right? So here, let me go a bit quickly. So in cold atoms, people use driving and shaking to modify and engineer the properties of their system. So for example, they can take trivial block bends, shake their optical lattice in the right way, and then end up with something that looks like the Haldane model, right? So they can really tune between topologically trivial and non-trivial block bends. And of course, once you shake an interacting system, you don't have energy conservation, right? So it does not behave as a Hamiltonian system eventually, right? So because ultimately the physical reason for that is heating, right? Which prevents you from constructing some physically reasonable effective Hamiltonian that would approximate your evolution of a driven system. And it turns out that MBL actually allows you to circumvent that, and it can suppress heating in your system. And based on that fact, so people have been discussing non-equilibrium phases with strange properties like time crystal, and you can also have in two dimension, for example, you can have phases with new topology like anomalous Floquet insulators, which are, have protected chiral edge states and are localized in the bulk. So it looks a bit like quantum Hall effect, except here edge states persist at any temperature, right? And that's a very interesting development. So today this is just to, give you a more complete picture of the field, but what I want to tell you a little bit more about is, what do we have in terms of non-ergodic behavior, but beyond many-body localization. So, and here we have, let me flash again this comparison slide of ergodic and MBL. And you see that they're sort of on the opposite edges, right? Of the, what is possible. So ergodic states are as entangled as possible, while MBL are very, very sort of weakly entangled. And, it's natural to wonder whether there are phases with intermediate properties. And for example, with different scaling of entanglement as an area law. And here, we've been focusing on a couple of possibilities. And first possibility is to consider disordered systems with non-abelian symmetries. And that I want to tell you a little bit more about. Another example, which also I think, on that there has been very nice work from coming out of perimeter from actually several groups, is quantum many-body scars. And that's a non-ergodicity without disorder, but rather, slow thermalization for certain initial states, right? So some, majority of states would actually thermalize, but there are some special initial states which are physical, but they either show no thermalization or very slow thermalization. These have been really brought into focus by an experimental discovery with Rydberg atom simulator. And then there is the third story, which is pre-thermalization, right? Which is states which thermalize, but just parametrically slowly. And that's also an interesting direction, but beyond our focus today. So Okay, so let me tell you a little bit more about non-abelian symmetries. And let's start by considering a simplest model of that kind, SU2 symmetric disordered Heisenberg model. So let's say we have a spin chain, S dot S interaction with random couplings. And the first very interesting observation is that actually SU2 symmetry precludes area law eigenstates. Why is that? That's because you know that the exact eigenstates would come in multiplets with a total spin that typically would grow as you increase the system size. And when I am connecting two systems of size, you know, with the total spin SL and SR, they will have to, this multiplets will have to be decomposed at the very least into the multiplets of the total spin of the whole system, right? So you need to use Clebsch-Gordan coefficients and all that. And that dictates that the minimum amount of entanglement you can have in this system is actually logarithmic in L. In other words, so here, some integrals of motion must become non-local. So the simple picture that I started from can no longer apply here. And the question is, you know, where do you go from there? So can you imagine a phase or a regime where eigenstates would actually have log-L entanglement, but no more, right? And an approach that we pursued in this direction was like this. So we said, so you can imagine that the minimal structure that is allowed by symmetry is essentially to fuse nearby spin states into some states of with a total spin of this pair of spins, right? And keep adding them like that. And naturally you would expect that the spins which are strongly coupled, you know, maybe the eigenstates would have total spin of these two strongly coupled spins as an approximate eigenstate, as an approximate conserved quantity, right? So that's a cartoon picture of what this phase might be like. And you know, to test this picture, so we studied a model with a distribution of couplings which looks like that. So it's 1 over j to some power, and this power controls the strength of disorder, right? So if alpha is small, that's a strong disorder, so neighboring couplings would typically be very different, and if alpha is approximately 1, then it would be weak disorder. And you know, we construct this tentative eigenstates using strong disorder real space renormalization group, which was successfully applied to ground states in the 80s and 90s and after, right? But we apply it to excited states. And what we find that at least for small systems, you know, of, let's say up to 20 or 25 spins, actually at strong disorder, this three tensor network produces a good approximation to eigenstates. So here it's evidenced by the participation ratio of the approximate states that you get from RG in the basis of exact eigenstates, right? So you see that it remains really of order 1, even though your Hilbert space dimension is really becomes very large, right? So from this, you know, from this small systems, you can also look at other things. And you can, for example, look at the standard measure of ergodicity and its breakdown, which is level statistics. And so here I'm showing this spectral statistics parameter, R, so I'm not going to define what it is. If, you know, if somebody is curious and haven't seen it, just ask me. And I'm plotting how it scales with the system size and disorder. So different curves are different disorders, different alphas. L are, yeah, different system sizes. And normally you expect that in a system that is ergodic, level statistics follows this Wigner-Dyson random matrix prediction, so top line here. While if you have lots of conservation laws, you have Poisson statistics. So levels do not feel each other, they don't repel. And you see from this picture that a strong disorder, you seem to flow actually to the Poisson, right? So it seems that the system becomes more and less ergodic as you increase its size. And it's consistent with other probes such as entanglement, ETH, and so on. So if you just had this information, just this finite size, you know, study, you would said, well, this kind of looks like a transition, right? So maybe this is truly a phase, right? A new non-ergodic phase, which is not like MBL, which has this other structure of conservation laws. But of course, you know, stopping at 25 spin is not very satisfying. So we came up with an approach to essentially probe the stability, right? Stability of real space RG to inclusion of many body processes. So usually the way you work in this real space RG, you just keep track of sort of nearby spins, right? But really, of course, if we want to study thermalization with it, so we also need to include multi-spin processes. And we developed technology to do that, which allows you to capture probably the main subset of many body processes which might lead to delocalization, and you can go to pretty big systems of, you know, beyond 1,000 spins. What we can track with it is essentially the density of resonance spins in your system. And so here I'm showing to you the scaling of density of resonance spins, like probability that you have some, you know, resonant process, which essentially would destabilize this tree and this perturbative procedure you do in real space RG. And x-axis is RG scale divided by system size. So once you come to one, right? So essentially this way, right? Your system size become, your number of spins you keep becomes less and less, right? So you're approaching the top of this tree, right? So essentially the RG steps go this way in the negative X direction. And you see that generally, even a strong disorder, right, this fraction of resonance spins keeps growing, and this suggests that eventually there would be this very long time scales and very slow process which would destabilize the trees and would lead to thermalization. And we can come up with some rough estimate of at which length scale this would happen. So our current thinking is that eventually this, you know, entanglement pattern is eventually inconsistent with complete absence of ergodicity at long scales, right? But nevertheless, the thermalization timescales can be extremely long, and you have a very broad new regime of non-ergodic dynamics, right, which would likely dominate experiments, right? So effectively, yeah.
Yeah, I'm confused about value of alpha. So alpha characterizes the distribution of disorder, the exchanges. Yeah. So I would have thought that for small alpha, for alpha near one, distribution is broad because it doesn't fall off at that
exchange. Yeah, so yeah, Leo, I think it's just definition we chose. So you should see this formula, right? So we just chose, probably you're thinking about 1 over j to alpha, while we chose it as 1 over j to 1 minus alpha. So for us, it's flipped.
Well, so imagine, I guess I'm, so imagine alpha is like 0.9. Mm-hmm. Then the distribution is very broad in j. So there's
a lot of... If my alpha is 0.1, I get 1 over j...
No, 0.9. Let's say your alpha is 0.9.
If alpha is 0.9, so okay, so if alpha is 1, right?
Yeah, then I just doesn't fall off.
Hmm? doesn't fall off. Ah, okay, okay.
I think the confusion is that Dima, I think you're talking about the tail to small values of J, right? Whereas exactly, Leo, you might be talking about the tail to large values.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. So I should have specified. So we cut it off at one, exactly.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
No. Yeah, I should have specified. Yeah, thanks, Leo, for pointing it out.
Okay. Thanks. Okay.
So and then of course, you know, interesting question is whether it's like that just for SU2 or for any continuous non-abelian symmetry. We don't have a full answer, but so recently we with Roman Vasseur and Braden, where we sort of extended this approach to discrete non-abelian groups, and there we find also similar behavior to SU2. But we don't know, you know, and interesting thing here is that it seems that what matters is essentially representations of your symmetry group, right? Because at every node of this tree, you have to think about Clebsch-Gordan coefficients and then multi-spin processes, right, which are driven by local operators. They're just some long products of this Clebsch-Gordans, right? So it's really, you know, really the representations of the symmetry groups that matter. And in the future, it would be interesting to maybe extend it to other continuous non-abelian groups, right? Because a priori, it could be that there is a group for which this really becomes a phase. So are there any questions? So, and I want to skip actually, I want to skip.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, yeah.
So you lost me there a little bit. So this process that you're showing here, does it depend on the range of the interaction between spins?
Mm-hmm. Well, I started out with a truly local interaction,
yeah. You sure did, yeah. That was nearest neighbors, but...
Yeah, yeah. So, and I stick with that.
Can I ask you a real question I have? And then...
Yes, if you correct, real is even better.
So, am I understanding right the concept of this resonance spin that basically, say I have a single spin in a random field, then, you know, single spin flip basically is non-resonant. Typically, there is a field that it feels, right? But if I consider several spin flips, then this may cost no energy, and then this is a resonant configuration somehow. Is that the
exactly? So you always it's always a game between a matrix element for this process, right? Because let's say to flip this spin and the one far away, you'll have to go through a lot of things in between, right?
That's right. That's why the question is about the range of the interaction. But yes, please.
Yeah. So that's exactly right.
Okay, so now let's go back and to the question about the range of interaction. You said that here you're sticking with the local one, and you know things are the way you described. But if it's a dipolar interaction, is it local enough for you or not? One over RQ
here. So dipolar, I don't know.
Which of course is always there, right, for actual spins, but.
For actual spins in, let's say, in diamond, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
For you know, if you have, let's say, something like phosphorus-doped silicon, I don't know. There, I think, I don't know if you should worry about it. But here, you know, here we are playing a slightly different game because here, you know, our basis is already slightly entangled, right? And because of that, even local interactions produce multi-spin processes, right? So that's the game here. But ultimately, we are doing the same thing. So we are trying to evaluate matrix element, right? And energy mismatch, so it's exactly...
No, that's the usual, you know, localization argument, right?
Yeah.
Kind of, so, yeah.
So now, mm-hmm. whether dipolar interactions would matter, so my naive guess of... Probably not. Probably this regime would still be there as long as disorder is strong enough, right? So I don't. But that's interesting. I think that's something that can be also analyzed within this approach?
It's just, you know, with Coulomb interaction, you know how these there is this energy transfer process, right? When you kind of excite one dipole and de-excite the other dipole, and nobody moves anywhere, but you exchange energy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you know, is there something like that here?
Yeah. So maybe, okay, you're touching, I think, on an interesting point, right? So here, indeed, if you have power law interactions, right, there are these ideas that, depending on dimensionality, that might be enough to completely forbid MBL. That, I think, also, so there are many, many open questions there, right? So, for example, you know, interesting thing is that long-range interactions can induce glassiness also, right? Which kind of suppress thermalization. And that's an interesting interplay. But the question, so in this context of non-abelian symmetry, so I think many of the arguments that people had, you know, for why long-range interactions in some dimensionality wouldn't necessarily induce thermalization, they would apply here as well. That's true. But they would not apply in one dimension, right? So I think in one dimension, there is a chance that, or maybe even in two dimensions, right? Because that argument depends on dimensionality. Sort of like, you know, in the original Anderson story, if you have power law hopping, there is also a critical exponent for this hopping, beyond which, you know, if you make them more long range than that, then you destroy localization.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions? No. Okay, so then let me... Oh, yeah, I see Anton.
Oh, no, I thought Lee Smolin had his hand raised, but...
My hand is raised. It's a very brief question. Where do proteins fit into this classification? Because you lack ergodicity because there are combinatorially so many possible proteins.
Mm-hmm.
There are 20 to the 1,000 or something, 20 to the n. So you can't reach ergodicity, you can't ever thermalize, but just because the dimension, the number of possible systems overwhelms anything else.
Yeah, so I think this is, we are in a sense, so I think proteins, there probably you also have to think about, you know, how different pieces fit together, right? And there are lots of possibilities. And that to me, you know, seems more like glassiness maybe.
Right.
So here we are in a sense, and glassiness in principle, it's a classical phenomenon, right? It's right. Stems from frustration and, you know, you can make local moves, but then the global outcome would not be determined, you know, somehow you develop non-local correlations, right?
Right.
In some sense. So here I think we are doing something different, which is more quantum and which does not have this component of frustration.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you.
Right. But indeed, I think it's very interesting to ask if you have a classically glassy system, like let's say certain proteins, then what does its quantum dynamics look like? And that I think has been largely unexplored.
Great. Okay. I'd love to talk about that with you.
Yeah, happily. Yeah. Thanks, Lee, for the question.
Okay.
So any other questions? So if not, so I guess I have 5 minutes. Right. So let me skip the part about scars because I'm sure you know. Some of you heard about it, and since people work on that at Perimeter, although if people are not coming in, I guess it makes it complicated. But let me just in the remaining 5 minutes tell you about the most recent thing that we've been doing and that, you know, we're quite excited about, which is quite different actually from what I told you so far. And so, and we call it influence matrix approach to quantum many body dynamics. And the idea is that, you know, throughout my talk, I've been highlighting a few different approaches, right? Perturbative, numerical, some tensor networks, and so on. But ultimately, the physics we are trying to describe, right, is the how does a many-body system act as a quantum bus? Right, so ergodic systems can act as a heat bus for their subsystems, well, and Bayer ones cannot. And let me try actually to take maybe the most complete description of a system as a quantum bus and try to apply it to a many-body context and see where we'll get with that. And the idea, you know, the idea goes back to Feynman and Vernon, right? I guess Vernon was his PhD student, and they came up with this nice way of describing an interaction of a quantum system with a quantum bus. They were mostly thinking about a linear bus, so a bus of oscillators. But the idea was, let's say you have a system described by coordinate X and the bus, it was vice versa, and the bus described by, so Q was the system, I guess, and X was the coordinates of the oscillators which act as a bus. And then the idea was, let's go to the path integral representation of systems dynamics and integrate out the bus degrees of freedom. And we will get, so the price we would pay, we would get an action for system coordinate only. And because, you know, you want to compute probabilities, you would have to have forward and backward trajectory. So like in Keldysh formalism, but the price you pay is that this action would be very non-local in general. There has been, you know, this idea has been fruitfully used in, you know, many subsequent works, in particular to study two-level system which is interacting with different oscillator bus, right? So there is this very famous Revmotfiz from Leggett and collaborators from 1989, which really pushes this approach. And, you know, the basic intuition, again, I'll have to be sketchy because I'm essentially out of time. The basic intuition is that let's say if I think about dynamics of a spin, so I have a forward trajectory sigma of t and backward trajectory sigma bar of t. Trajectories where forward and backward is the same, those are just probabilities, right? Those are classical contributions, classical trajectories. While...
Sorry, Dima, Lee, do you have a question again?
Or maybe he just forgot to lower hand? No.
Okay, I guess not. Sorry. Yeah, you can. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, but yeah, it's good to keep an eye on the hands. So while quantum trajectories where sigma of t is not the same as a sigma bar, those describe interference contributions, right? And you need to sum over all these trajectories. And the basic intuition is that, you know, when your system interacts with a bus, bus measures it in some sense, and that kills interference and suppresses quantum trajectories, right? So simple, you know, simple kind of influence functional, right? This non-local influence functional you can have looks something like that. So it's exponential of a quadratic functional with some kernel, which, you know, has a, which is decaying, right? And which makes quantum trajectories pay a certain price. And, you know, what we try to do, so we try to apply this way of thinking to a many-body system. And the idea was to start with a Floquet spin system. So we consider a protocol where, you know, spins are being first kicked along, you know, kicked, you essentially do a rotation and then you make spins interact, right? With sigma z interaction. So you have two parameters, strength of the kick and strength of the interaction. This model is not integrable when, you know, this third parameter H is non-zero. And you can write the time evolution of your system in the Keldysh form, you know, with such a tensor network. And the idea that we pursued is to say, well, let's consider influence functional that the system exerts on a given spin, we call it influence matrix because our evolution is discrete. It just makes things easier. It's not so important. Of course, you cannot integrate out spins like oscillators, right? Because they're nonlinear. But instead, you can write a self-consistency equation for this influence functional, influence matrix, right? Which just tells you that spin interacting under the influence of the bus to the left should produce the same bus to its neighbor on the right as it's feeling, provided you have translational invariant, translational invariants. And so, and the surprise, so we can, you know, in terms of tensor networks, you can write it as some many-body transfer matrix equation. So essentially the eigenvector of this transfer matrix, you know, which is pictorially shown here, is just the influence, self-consistent influence matrix. And you got this type of self-consistency equation. It looks a priori horrible, right? But there is a couple of surprises that came. So first surprise is that there are models where you can solve this exactly. Chaotic models, thermalizing models. And what you need to do is to just imagine the simplest possible form of a thermalizing influence matrix, which is we call perfect dephaser. So it just completely, you know, it punishes quantum trajectories so much that the influence matrix becomes zero. So it essentially forces the forward and backward trajectory to be the same everywhere except in the initial state. So you can say that the system measures each spin at every step of time evolution. And for the model that I mentioned, so it turns out there are many systems which do that, but the model that I mentioned, you just need to choose the particular values of the parameters epsilon and j. And this model is chaotic. So there is level repulsion, yet you can compute various things about its time evolution. You can go beyond that probably, and you know this might be a nice new way to find solvable models of quantum dynamics. But now the next thing that I'll just take 1 minute. I can also now try to detune from the solvable points, right, to get a more general insight into thermalizing dynamics, and then I can view this influence matrix as a fictitious wave function in the space of trajectories, right? In the time domain, if you wish. And I know that at solvable points, it is just a product state, so it has zero entanglement. And it means that if I detune slightly away from it, it would have a low temporal entanglement, right? Which opens the door to efficient matrix product state simulations. And we've done that, and turns out you can get some mileage out of it, and there is some, you know, universal features of the influence matrix that emerge. And our, you know, at the moment, our sort of dream is that maybe by thinking about classes of self-consistent influence matrices, we can actually get an insight into universality classes of quantum dynamics. Right, so it seems to give you some new angle and very different formulation of the quantum many-body dynamics problem. And so, and hopefully we'll have some more news in that direction soon. Hopefully things would go faster now that we'll probably get locked up again. And so let me stop here. So I try to give you a pretty broad overview of where things are in terms of studying quantum many-body dynamics of isolated systems. So finding things which do not thermalize proved to be interesting, and there is a couple of at least regimes which, you know, which seem to be non-ergodic beyond many-body localization, like quantum scars and non-abelian symmetries and strong disorder. And finally, so I told you, you know, I hope I at least managed to convey the idea of this influence matrix approach to quantum dynamics. And this adventure continues, so experiments move forward, so hopefully this progress will even accelerate in the next years. And let me stop by thanking many collaborators, you know, from the earlier things I mentioned and the current group in Geneva. So this influence matrix stuff was done with Alessio, who is a postdoc now, and Michael Sonner, who is a PhD student, so just finished first year. So thanks a lot. If there are any remaining questions.
Thank you, Dima, for a very nice talk. So I think there were a couple of raised hands, so you can just unmute yourself and ask a question.
I have a question. Hello.
Hello, hello. So
can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
Going back to the early part of your talk where you talked about the logarithmic in time growth of the some correlation length over which you're obtaining this many body localization. Is that an analytically derived result? You showed some numerics, but is that also an analytically derived result?
Yes. So you can perturbatively, perturbatively construct this conserved quantities.
Okay.
Right.
And then I have a question. The characteristic time in that logarithm, let me say it's log of t over t naught. Does t naught depend upon the root mean square disorder, or does it depend upon rare states?
So this is not rare state. So I think it would be more
root mean square.
Exactly.
Okay. So it's simply a question of distribution of barriers. In effect,
in a sense, yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's interesting because that kind of log of t is another way of stating 1/f noise in systems, and mm-hmm. and which you observe in glasses and many disordered systems, and they are really quantum mechanical. We are looking at very low temperatures. Okay, they're mm-hmm. not classical. So I found that very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dima? Yeah, this is Matthew Fisher. Great talk, incidentally. Really enjoyed it. Particularly this influence matrix approach. Is that going to be less effective with disorder in the MBL context because everything's sort of too local and maybe more effective in the chaotic regimes where you looked at it? Or is there a hope that you could add in disorder and make some progress?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there is hope. So indeed, this simple solution, of course, which we wrote, that's purely for quickly thermalizing systems. There things got really simple, right? And it's nice because it's a different axis of simplification somehow, right? You rely now on low temporal entanglement. In the MBL case, things are messy. So we know some things, right? But I think the solution has a complicated structure. Although the entanglement does not grow very fast, so and that's good news. So at least numerically, one can make some progress, right? Whether one can really solve it, right? That would be great, and we are trying. But probably, you know, this is a little bit like trying to write a noise action for a system which is somehow fractal noise, right? It's a noise which is very structured, and then you have to average over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know if you've seen something like that, that would be very, very useful. But we somehow couldn't find anything of that type. So you have a noise at certain frequencies, right? And then you go into the time domain and you have to somehow write a generating functional for it.
Yeah, things may not decay very quickly in time.
Right.
In that case.
And I guess the question that we're facing, how exactly it decays and how much structure of the trajectory you need to keep.
Okay, thank you.
You're in the MBL phase, you should be able to make things that don't decay at all, you know, coherences that live forever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So coherences live forever. Now, in terms of this action, right, this action of influence matrix action, right, there things would still decay, because it's a little bit, I think the intuition is that another way to view this is that your bath is moving in the field creating by the trajectory, right? So it's some, also you can view this influence matrix as some correlation function of the bath. But yeah, maybe David, yeah, maybe.
But if there is no bath, you know, couldn't that make sense? Mm-hmm. Right, in the MBL phase, there is no bath. So can that make sense?
But you can still, right, so it's more a question of, you know, it's not a bath that is thermalizing, but it's still some many-body system which is coupled to your spin, right?
Yeah, but every initial state is different.
Yeah, right.
So you have a distribution of baths somehow.
Right, and good thing, and that's exactly the problem here, right? That's exactly the difficulty that you need to, but also it's an advantage, right? Because you can already work with ensembles of bath, right? Because the rule of it, you can just average this influence matrix over ensembles, over disorder distributions. That's an attractive feature.
Can I ask a question, Dima?
Yeah.
Hi.
Tarun, that's Tarun.
Hi, yeah, this is Tarun.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Very nice talk. Thank you. I had one technical question and one broader question. Technical question is about your last part about this influence matrix, where so when you in the case where you're analytically able to show these chaos, are those cases same as this dual unitary circuits, or is it a broader class? That's one question.
And yeah.
Right. And the second question was more about in the in one dimension, when you have bosons rather than like real bosons rather than fermions or spins, is it now understood that MBL exists as a phase of matter, or is it still like is some because of the infinite local Hilbert space? These are two questions. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. First, for the dual unitaries. So indeed, dual unitaries are perfect defasers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whether the inverse is true, we don't know. So for this particular case of kicked spin 1/2 spin chains, right?
Yes.
Ising models, so they're the same.
Right.
But it also it gives you a very perfect defaser condition is quite simple.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. It's more intuitive.
So you can also find these points for higher spins and so on, but formally we haven't been able to show, you know, if perfect defaser property implies dual unitarity. Naively, it seems broader, but maybe we're missing some nice mathematical trick to just show it. For the second question, mm-hmm. I think if you have, let's say, bosons on a lattice, mm-hmm. right, with on-site interaction, mm-hmm. I think, MBL would exist in one dimension at least.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Does the all the argument by Embry, do they go through, or is there some subtlety with the fact that there is a Hilbert space is infinite locally?
Yeah, I think so. Whether one could really... My guess is that it would be difficult. So... My guess that it would be a case where it would be difficult to prove things, because in general, mm-hmm. these unbounded Hilbert spaces are super annoying, right?
Right.
We recently actually, you know, spent a lot of time trying to derive pre-thermalization mm-hmm. results for
right.
that case with Wojciech and Wenwei.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're formally annoying, but maybe not because there is a real physical problem, but rather just a technical obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess it would be kind of similar in this case.
I see. And what about in continuum, either bosons or even fermions. Is that well understood? I don't know. You might not like continuum because it's kind of, you always, I don't know, we like regulators and so on, but still in practically experiments, sometimes they don't have any underlying lattice in cold atoms. They just have just a gas and maybe there's some,
what's the... It's not very well understood now.
Uh-huh.
I haven't... Yeah, I think it's... I mean... Yeah, I haven't seen much on that. And yeah, that's, of course, an interesting and important question.
Right, right.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have any else. Thank you. Thank you for very nice talks.
Thanks, Tarun.
Hey, Dima. Very nice talk.
Hey, Yehud.
Hi.
Ah, wait, you're muted.
Okay, now I'm fine. About your last influence functional approach, so I find it pretty similar to something that almost simultaneously, I think John Chalker and the student showed for, I think for the spectral form factor, they had a similar influence functional or transfer matrix approach. Mm-hmm. And there you could see that the chaotic dynamics came out as broken symmetry because your diagonal elements could be like n, about if you have n time steps, you could have n different cyclic permutations that give you this diagonal elements. And I wonder if one can understand the MBL transition from this point of view as some what is happening to the domain wall energy in these broken symmetry phases as you get closer to the MBL transition. I guess it's hard to understand really because there are highly non-local interactions in the time direction, but.
Exactly. That's the problem. So I think things become less and less local as you, I mean, you're right. We also noticed the paper from Sam Garrett and John Checker, very nice paper. And they also go, so I think it's ultimately a bit different what they do because they focus on the spectral form factor, right?
Right.
Well, here, you have this interpretation as an influence functional, but there are some parallels.
Do you see it also as a broken symmetry in the ergodic phase? Or it's not apparent in this formalism?
It's more, I think, in this formalism, it seems more like just interactions become local, right? You're essentially punishing. So in this famous Revmot-Fiz from 89, where this technology is used for oscillators,
mm-hmm.
right? So there, parts of the trajectory which are quantum, they're called blips, and and the classical parts are called sojourns. And here effectively, so on the thermal side, the blips would be expensive, right? So there would be a dilute, it would be some dilute gas of blips, right, that you have to worry about, while as you approach the transition, the interactions become very non-local, right?
Yes.
So from that point of view, it's more of some kind of binding, right? You have to bind these blips and anti-blips or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would be good to discuss it.
Yeah.
Discuss more and see whether indeed the symmetry that you find in spectral form factor, right? Whether it's something important or not.
Mm-hmm. I think this comes in from the periodic boundary conditions you have from tracing, right, in the time direction. And you're not doing that in time or here?
Here we have, so we are thinking mostly about time evolution, right? Yeah. So we had open boundary conditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and then you just feed, in this tensor network, you just feed the initial density matrix here.
Right. Right. Then there is no, if you're not tracing, then there is no real symmetry, I guess. You can't have
permutations. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, but yeah, I think there are lots of interesting questions.
Any more questions?
So I see Markus.
Yeah, Dima, thank you for a nice talk. Well, maybe first a comment about the continuum question of Tarun. I think we have more or less argued that the continuum is detrimental to localization, right? Because you have nearly mobility edges, and if you go high enough in energy, chaos breaks loose, no? Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
So, and that in one dimension you also find, because I remember you had an argument in two dimension, right? But
well, yeah, in one dimension the localization length grows with energy quite rapidly, certainly if you have finite length correlations in your potential, and then you just have many resonances at high energies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then basically you can argue that there will always be a many-body bomb, delocalization at high energy, and then there's an avalanche effect due to that. So our conclusion was that the lattice was really necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But then I wanted to ask you about the inference functional and possible relation to what people try to do in the quantum cavity approach, where you basically, instead of doing kind of mean field theory on trees, where you have just a local field, you say there's a field in time, and you have to give a weight to the time history of spins. Have you thought to compare, you know, your approach to that and maybe extend what you did now in one dimension to sort of trees or bigger lattices to kind of simulate higher dimension?
That would be nice. That would be very nice. Yeah. So we thought about it very briefly, but more about Cayley tree, right?
Yeah.
So that would be interesting. And maybe, you know, we can chat some more, and you know, I would love to see those papers on.
I mean, I just remember that those approaches were hopeless in the sense that the action in time required so many parameters, and it just led nowhere, basically. I think, but since you have these nice dephasing points, maybe one can do something around those perturbatively or so. Then
yeah. So I think that's one, one thing that we know, that yeah, indeed, around this perfect dephaser points, right? Or maybe there are other solvable points. Things you can have some control.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
I do have bit of a naive question. So going back to what you were talking about with respect to quantum computation, so could you maybe just briefly outline kind of the goal and the progress that's been made with applying these states that are, or sorry, these systems that are slow to thermalize? What is the goal in terms of how that might be applied to quantum computation? My understanding was just that if you start with some quantum state and it was slow to thermalize, then that would mean that errors would spread slowly. But yeah, I would love to hear more of your thoughts on that.
Thanks for the question. So I think not much has been done, right? It's still more at the just at the stage of understanding effects, right, and trying to understand the system. Whether one could do, play some of these tricks to, let's say, preserve entangled states you have, right? That's a possible direction. right? Let's say you try to preserve a state by cranking up disorder, but it hasn't been done. And this is, you know, I think any concrete ideas in that direction would be very valuable.
So is the idea with scarring that if you start with some state and then, you know, let the system evolve for some amount of time, you can still recover something about the initial state even after some like large time? Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's what also, that was, you know, that's what people seen in those experiments with Rydberg atom arrays, right? So just for certain initial state, there is a many-body revival, right? Periodic or near revival, right? Which is surprising because other initial states just become thermalized, become highly entangled, right? But there is a special set of initial states and a special corresponding set of non-thermal eigenstates which are responsible for the observed revivals.
So is that at all similar to when someone is doing like a Markov chain Monte Carlo and you start with some initial state and then, you know, sometimes if you evolve it for even a long time, like many different steps, it's still strongly correlated with the initial state?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it's probably different. Okay. Naively.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the question.
Okay. Any other questions?
I have a question. So you made an analogy early on between the MBL case and, you know, the where you have strong disorder and an integrable system. And you said that there's these kind of action angle variables that you can invent in the MBL sort of case, or at least in the very strong disorder case. And so the whole idea with regular integrable systems is that you have these tori and the motion lives on a tori. And then when you add some weak perturbations, the tori are preserved. So they don't explode, they somehow are stable against these perturbations. So I wondered what are the analogs of the tori in your case, in the disordered case?
Mm-hmm. So well, in this case, I think it's kind of difficult to think about you know, so if I start from some initial state, right, the trajectory of the system is not periodic because there is this slow generation of entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Even in the, I mean, going really to the strongly localized case, there's not even a quasi-periodic.
If it is strongly localized, I think so. Every spin would sort of precess in the field created by its neighbors, right? So maybe that's it, but then it would slowly pick up phases and get entangled with further and further degrees of freedom. Yeah.
Can we think of local tori that are sort of localized?
That one could probably think of, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Space. Mm. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the question.
Okay, so I think we should stop here. It's already pretty late. So thank you very much, Dima, again for a very nice and very stimulating talk. And well, thanks to the audience for attending. And well, we hope to see you again next week.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, and thanks for lots of great questions. Bye.
Thank you. Everyone.
Thanks, Dima. Good seeing you, man.
Yeah, likewise, Roger.